Hi, and welcome to part two of this episode of Leech Fest. This is an episode on assassinations, and it became quite long, so this is part two. But if you want to listen to part one, go back one episode, and you get to hear stories about catty gays and fun religious fanatics. But if you listen to that and would like to listen to part two, stay here, and we'll get right into the episode.
While Rasputin was busy laying his magic hands on Alexei and also half of St. Petersburg, Russia was undergoing major political changes following serious social unrest. Russia's defeat in the Russo-Japanese War, combined with poor working conditions in the cities, peasant poverty, and widespread shortages across the country, led to an increase in worker strikes, peasant revolts, and military mutinies. The unrest and agitation came to a head in St. Petersburg on the 3rd of January 1905, when a strike broke out at the Putilov Works in the city, a strike which grew to include 140,000 strikers by the 7th of January, and which eventually became known as Bloody Sunday. The name Bloody Sunday is due to the garrison opening fire on the protesters outside the palace, leading to widespread death. However, the revolution did lead to the Tsar softening his previously autocratic stance and allowing the establishment of the Duma, as well as the implementation of the Russian Constitution of 1906. The January events were orchestrated by a number of revolutionaries, but one of the major figures in the revolution was Leon Trotsky, originally Lev Davidovich Bronstein. Of course, the 1905 revolution was not the beginning of his career as a political revolutionary. He had been involved in a number of organizations since 1896, working to popularize socialist ideas among industrial workers, first via pamphlets and proclamations, and then by working for Iskra, which means the spark.
That's such a good name.
Yeah, and there, I remember they even had a slogan. It was something like, a spark starts a fire. So it had a reason for why it was named the spark. I thought that was interesting.
The Swedish communist equivalent was called the flame. Mm-hmm. Actually, the northern flame.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Flame of the Aurora Borealis, actually.
Wow.
Speaking of which. Like, they got good branding for like leftist magazines. Mm-hmm. So you're saying he had poster energy.
So Iskra was a political newspaper which had actually been founded by Lenin and whose goal was to popularize the ideas of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, RSDLP. Lenin actually was one of the founders of the party. So Trotsky worked with Lenin on a number of projects. However, his friendship with Lenin came to a halt, no longer best friends, in 1898, following a disagreement over the party's organization. So Lenin was of the opinion that the party should be smaller and highly organized and primarily led by professional revolutionaries.
And the vanguardists.
Yeah, and these were the Bolsheviks, like the people who were of this opinion. Whereas the opposing part, the Mensheviks, which Trotsky subscribed to, believed that the party should be bigger but less disciplined, so more open to the public. This clash led to Lenin referring to Trotsky as Little Judas, as well as a scoundrel and a swine.
Again, like, leftists love having, like, disagreements over,
calling,
like,
each other scoundrels.
Very, scoundrels. Like, small things in the end, you know? Because they're disagreeing about, like, the structure of the movement while they're opposing, like, the autocratic czar. Mm-hmm. Just, like, there's a big gap you can get through. Mm-hmm. Like, once that matters, mm-hmm. like, why do you have to do that now? Mm-hmm. Anyway, friendship ended with...
Friendship ended with Lenin. But I will say, while Trotsky and Lenin did have some ideological differences, Trotsky did continue to write for revolutionary newspapers, and he was actively involved in the growing Workers' Council, the Soviet. So they still worked together. The Russian Revolution of 1917, caused by long-term dissatisfaction with the regime, as well as the recent failures on the war front, led to the Tsar's abdication in February and the dissolution of the provisional government in October, followed by the Bolsheviks' rise to power and the formation of the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic, RSFSR. So the Bolsheviks' takeover gave Trotsky the opportunity to advance his political career very rapidly, and he eventually became Lenin's right-hand man and heir presumptive.
He became like the head of the Red Army too, right?
Yeah, he took a bunch of roles.
Yeah.
But he was definitely very involved militarily.
There's a fun, because like in the Russian Civil War, after this, after like a bunch of people were like, no, I don't like Lenin being in charge, fuck that shit. Trotsky like travels around Russia on an armored train, just like zooms around everywhere to solve like battles himself with this like weirdly uniformed like elite Red Guard soldiers, and that's his job. He's like Lenin's fixer.
Mm-hmm. However, following Lenin's deteriorating illness and eventual death in 1922, Trotsky was sidelined by Stalin and was ultimately expelled from the Communist Party 5 years later. He moved between Turkey, France, and Norway, and eventually settled in Mexico, in the home of painters Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo,
yeah.
Which, fun little tidbit, he ended up having an affair with.
Yeah, it's a fun little story. People forget that about Frida Kahlo, like, raging communist,
mm-hmm.
like, has fucked Leon Trotsky.
I really did not make that connection before.
No, I know, like, a lot of people don't. Like,
doing the notes.
Yeah.
Also, damn, Diego Rivera got cucked. Like, imagine letting a man stay in your house and he fucks your wife.
From what I've heard from their relationship, like, I feel like they
probably... Pretty bohemian.
Yeah, like, I think he was fine with it, honestly, from what I've heard.
Mm.
He may have fucked Trotsky, too. It's possible.
Okay. In Mexico, Trotsky, just because he was in Mexico doesn't mean that he stopped his career. He wrote prolifically, criticizing the current Soviet government for being undemocratic and doomed to fail, which Stalin did not particularly appreciate.
This Stalin is a skank not to be trusted.
Yeah. In one of his writings, he said that if the Soviet government continues to be as it is now, it will either be toppled by the Russian people or it will end up a capitalist shithole. So he had quite strong opinions about how Russia was led.
The spirit of Rasputin leaving Rasputin's body transferred into Trotsky to give more like prescient knowledge of the future.
In any case, in 1939, following a quarrel with Rivera, maybe about previously...
cucking my wife. Stop cucking me.
Trotsky moved to another home, which would be his final residence. Dun dun dun. As mentioned, Stalin was infuriated with Trotsky's open dissent and organized a first assassination attempt. In May 1940, NKVD agents surrounded his villa, spraying hundreds of bullets at the house. However, Trotsky and his family were unharmed. This led to him writing an article titled, "Stalin Seeks My Death."
Which... This guy's trying to kill me.
Please help.
Please help, God in heaven.
God.
They shot up my house.
But basically, he stated in the article that another attempt was underway.
Mm.
And he was right. On August 20th, 1940, Trotsky was attacked in his study by a Canadian citizen named Frank Jackson.
That's so funny how Stalin's just like, right, like...
Yeah, bitch,
Canadian.
Right.
Like hires a Canadian to do it, too.
He was in the end Spanish, but we'll get to that.
Hello, Frank. I know you are Canadian. I would like you to kill him for me. This dialect, I had no idea what that is.
Jackson had become a frequent visitor to the house. He often dropped by to discuss his manuscripts and also like ongoing political events. Trotsky, which is what allowed him access to his house and his office. Like, especially after the first assassination attempt, Trotsky had a lot of armed guards and, you know, bodyguards and people.
You get a little cagey.
You do get a little cagey, but this guy, Jackson, made his way into Trotsky's heart and home.
Weaseled his way in.
On that day, Jackson was seen carrying a hat and an overcoat, which was an unusual outfit choice in the hot weather. The visitor's overcoat concealed an ice axe, which he used to split Trotsky's head using its wide end, the adze. In court, he described the events as such. "I laid my raincoat on the table in such a way as to be able to remove the ice axe, which was in the pocket. I decided not to miss the wonderful opportunity that presented itself."
The wonderful opportunity.
"The moment Trotsky began reading the article, he gave me my chance. I took out the ice axe from the raincoat, gripped it in my hand, and with my eyes closed, dealt him a terrible blow on the head. The blow, turns out, was dealt to the side of the head, fracturing his parietal bone and penetrating 7 centimeters into his brain." And, girl, you don't know what 7 centimeters is until you look at it on a ruler.
It's a lot.
I have this handy-dandy ruler here.
It's a lot. It's into the brain.
It's this much into the brain.
You can't hear that, dear listeners, but
it's quite a lot. 7 centimeters is a lot. It's like, what, 4 inches or something? Following the blow, Trotsky let out a horrible scream, and despite his injury, grappled fiercely with his attacker, and even managed to break his hand. Hearing the commotion, Trotsky's bodyguards rushed into the office and nearly beat the attacker to death. But Trotsky stopped them, insisting that the attacker must be questioned. He was rushed to the hospital, where he was immediately transferred to the operating room and treated by an already assembled team of neurosurgeons led by Dr. Joaquin Mas-Patino. Mas had previously written an article describing his method for treating gunshot wounds to the skull, which we can assume formed the basis for his surgical approach in Trotsky's case. As soon as Trotsky arrived at the hospital, an x-ray of his skull was produced, his hair shaved, and a 25-centimeter square trepanation drilled into the skull. It was found that the meninges were torn and that the brain was herniated through the wound. The meninges are three layers of protective tissue that envelop the brain. It's just an added protective layer. Mm-hmm. And brain herniation is a side effect of high pressure within the skull, such as when part of the brain is squeezed across other structures. Mm. And this is often fatal because pressure can lead to the interruption of blood flow to the affected brain parts and can lead to widespread death of brain cells. According to Mas, the first step in treating any penetrating wound to the head was to treat edema, and that trying to prevent bleeding would be useless because it was always uncontrollable, and that surgical intervention only added surgical shock and anesthetic intoxication. I think we can listen to the neurosurgeon.
No, I mean, I suppose so. I guess I'm not a neurosurgeon,
However, a main concern was the removal of pieces of skull embedded in the brain, as those could become sites of infection. So I think that's also why they did the trepanation, to remove what was left of the damaged skull, have good access to the brain, and then just pick out the pieces. Mm. So this was done during the surgery. Following the operation, Trotsky was moved to an adjacent ward and was given oxygen, but the doctor spoke very pessimistically of the prognosis. Mm. The next day, on August 21st, Trotsky's health deteriorated and he entered a coma. He was administered physiological serum and oxygen, but he did not improve. His wound was bleeding profusely and his ventricles were filling with blood. His breathing became fast and erratic, at which point his wife was told by the doctors that her husband was about to die. The last medical report stated that his condition was critical, with an elevated heart rate of 140 beats per minute, elevated breathing of 41, a temperature of 38 degrees Celsius, and low blood pressure of 78 over 66. The diagnosis that was given in the report was that of flooding of the brain ventricles, an extremely severe injury that darkens the prognosis. Ventricle flooding, in simple terms, can lead to compression of brain structures, such as the brainstem, which would impair vital bodily functions and lead to death. An hour and 25 minutes later, Trotsky's pulse became weak and adrenaline had no effect. His pupils were non-responsive and he was finally declared dead at 7:25 p.m. on August 21st, 1940, 25 hours and 35 minutes after being attacked by Jackson. His autopsy revealed a subdural hematoma and a 7-centimeter deep injury in the right hemisphere. And a subdural hematoma means bleeding occurring under the dura mater, which is one of those free membranes protecting the brain, one of the meninges. Immediately following the attack, he showed loss in function in his left hand and arm. So it is hypothesized that the blow damaged the motor neurons in the precentral gyrus. Although it is also possible that the hematoma caused cerebral compression, which led to those symptoms.
Yeah.
Following the autopsy, the body was taken to the main hall of the funeral home, which would be visited by thousands of Mexicans in the following days to pay their respects to the fallen leader. His body was cremated and his ashes were put to rest in a monument built in the garden of what used to be his house, just a few steps away from the place he was murdered.
I've been meaning to want to visit that place sometime.
Here's my question. Is that house still, like, used by people? Like, do people just live in a house with Trotsky in the backyard?
Look it up. I've heard that it's like a
museum, maybe.
Kind of, yeah. It's one of those like thing. Like a leftist organization probably bought it.
That would make more sense.
Let's see, Trotsky's. Yeah, it's a museum.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that makes sense.
It looks nice. You can see his house, his garden.
I saw some pictures of the office.
Tickets are like $2.
$2.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty good. He also has like multiple museums in Mexico, which I get. Mm. Not a lot of Trotsky museums in Russia, I bet. Stalin is just like, stop talking about this fucking guy.
So what of his murderer? Frank Jackson, also known as Jacques Mornard, was later found to be a Spanish communist with important connections to Stalin's secret police. He was tried and imprisoned in a Mexican prison for 20 years, and although the Soviet government never admitted responsibility, Stalin bestowed him with the highest distinction, Hero of the Soviet Union.
Of course. We didn't do it, but I mean,
great guy.
Great guy. Good job. Did an amazing job. What did he do? Well, kill a guy. Great job.
So that's the story of Trotsky. A little bit of thick Soviet Union history for you.
Mm. I do also like, I know I gave this as a comment like in your script about his name, because like we know him as Trotsky, but like that's very different from his birth name. And that's also true for Stalin and Lenin and like a lot of people involved in sort of like the communist revolution generally.
Mm-hmm.
And because I love how they all just sat down one day.
Decided like to get 1800s, cooler names.
Like the 1800s and be like, let's get some cool brand names.
Mm-hmm.
Let's really get in here. And to be fair to Stalin, like that's a good brand name. Joey Steele.
Stalin is good.
Which he got Trotsky, like between, you know, robbing banks and the Caucasus.
The name Trotsky, he just got from another guy that he met during one of his exiles to Siberia.
Oh.
I don't think it really means anything, if I remember correctly.
Sometimes the names are just like fun names.
He just met the guy and was like, you know what? Cool name.
It's a good name.
Let me have it.
Sounds nice. It's mine now. He beat his ass and took his name.
I think also, if I'm not wrong, he also took the name because he wanted to maybe conceal his Jewish identity a bit, because him being Jewish did interfere with his political career.
I have heard this.
So he wanted to like just, you know.
Well, I've mentioned that because Bernstein is a very, very Jewish name in that sense. It's kind of difficult to hide that if that's your like public last name. It is so interesting though that Stalin was so fucking paranoid about this guy that like many people around the world are talking shit about Stalin. A lot of people around the world are like promoting different types of communism and socialism and whatnot, but hated fucking Trotsky. So scared of him. He was really scared that like a lot of like Soviet generals and officials and like other like high-ranking politicians were gonna depose Stalin and bring Trotsky back to sort of like be the guy in charge. And that's also where you have like the great purges and stuff like that within Russia, like accusing everyone of being a Trotskyist. But it's good to hear though that like a lot of people in Mexico still, you know, like them, stuff like that. Trotskyism has a really bad name in like modern day leftist discourse, and there's a part of me that wonders like how much of that is due to like people genuinely reading about it and having like the idea that like, oh, I read his ideas, they're bad, and how much of it is just like people who have a weird sense of loyalty to the Soviet Union for some reason. Speaking of Stalinism, Trotskyism, I'm going to be talking about a different school, which is about North Korea. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Kim Jong-nam, his assassination, and the North Korean family drama that preceded it.
Love drama.
Love drama. There's more family drama here. And this is also one of the weird parts about North Korea specifically, because a lot of people, when analyzing North Korean politics, it makes more sense to view it as like dynastic politics rather than like traditional socialist politics. Because it is one family that has been in charge, and there's a very sort of like hierarchy within the family, which is not necessarily the case in, like, for example, the Soviet Union. Like, Lenin didn't put his kid in charge. Trotsky being the son of Lenin is a fun theory, but like, it's not obviously not true, you know what I mean?
His long lost son, Jewish son. I'll admit, I don't know so much about North Korean dynastic politics, so I'm very curious to hear this part.
So I don't have the most, I don't have like the background of like all of North Korean history here, because it's not really relevant in this specific assassination, but I can do like a quick run through basically, just for your pleasure and for the pleasures of our audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that is basically that during the Second World War, right at the end, as things were like, everyone knows how it's going to end. It's like 1945, Germany has already surrendered. We know it's over. It's Jover. Japan is still fighting China, invaded long before the war started, and has historically also owned the Korean Peninsula at this point for a long time. But Japan is not doing great currently in the war. They are about to have a nuclear weapon dropped on them twice. And the Soviet Union has not fought the Japanese on that front because they've been focused on Germany. Germany's out of the war now, and suddenly you have the entire Red Army going towards Japan and northern China specifically. And they swoop in to Manchuria, take over that part, and they also take over...
Retribution?
Because China is also involved in like a civil war at this time between like the communists and the nationalists. And they put that civil war on hold to fight the Japanese. So the Soviets swoop in, they take over Manchuria and large part of northern China, and they give it to Mao. To sort of like, we want the communists to win this one. But they also take over parts of Korea. Not all of it, which has led to problems that we are still dealing with today, with there being a north one and a south one. Because after Japan falls out of the war, there is like a split, same as there is in Germany. There is one Korea established in the north, under Kim Il-sung, and there's another Korea established in the south. We're not going to talk too much about South Korea, especially. It's not really relevant for this assassination. But North Korea becomes a communist nation that is mostly under the sway of the Chinese Communist Party. But they have their own like weird stylistic choices in the sense that they are very much wanting to be self-reliant. Their communist ideology is called Junche, which is entirely about like, we don't need to trade, we don't need to have interactions with the outside world, we take care of ourselves. Which is also a big part of the problems within the country. And also a reason why we don't know a lot about North Korea. But their connection to China is important. The Korean War, for example, also has to do with like a lot of support from China being the only reason why North Korea is still around, essentially. And that is relevant for the story. However, Kim Il-sung dies in the 70s, and his son, Kim Jong-il, which you maybe have heard of, takes over and rules the country after him. But we're talking about Kim Jong-nam. So we're going to talk about him and his assassination specifically and why all of this family drama kind of is important. So Kim Il-sung was born in the Soviet Union, but he was Korean and he was also a communist figure. So it made sense for him to sort of like be put in charge.
Hey, you're Korean. Do you want to rule a country?
I mean, he was also like a communist leader.
Okay.
He had his own sort of communist movement. But he was also kind of picked by the Soviets to be like, you. There's also a lot of myth-making around the Kim family because they want the story of the family to be sort of that they have, you know, they lived in North Korea and they fought out the Japanese on themselves. But the reality of the situation is that they were born in the Soviet Union and they... did not do much of the fighting themselves. That was mostly the Red Army of the Soviets. But there's a lot of myth-making here, right?
Always is.
There's a lot of myth-making around these things. But King Jong-nam, there's a lot of dynastic trees here. We're playing Crusader Kings, basically. King Jong-nam was the half-brother of current North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. And Kim Jong-nam was assassinated in an airport in Kuala Lumpur in 2017. At that time... there were a lot of people who were surprised at him being assassinated or even existing because a lot of people don't keep up with the details of the dynastic lineages of North Korean dictators. Now, their father, Kim Jong-il, had an affair with an actress in the 70s, Song Hye-rim, who is Kim Jong-nam's mother. And this could be very embarrassing to the regime and to Kim Jong-il's father, Kim Il-sung. Who is the father of North Korea and like the guy, he's the founding father. Like in the same way that like Americans worship George Washington, he has that spot for North Korea. But because this was embarrassing, Kim Jong-nam was hidden away from his grandfather, wasn't enrolled in school locally, and was first homeschooled and then eventually educated in Switzerland, much like his siblings, because it seems like Switzerland seems to be the place to get educated if you're the heir apparent for a dictator somewhere in the world. Now, King Jong-nam was for a long time thought to be the heir to the leadership of the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, after Kim Jong-il became the leader. He was, after all, the eldest boy, but as we saw, this is not how it turned out. One problem here is that we know precious little of the goings-on inside of North Korea, and there is plenty of propaganda on all sides that make any information extremely difficult to verify. And when I say propaganda, like, a lot of time people say like, oh, okay, propaganda, how much propaganda is there entirely? North and South Korea make dedicated, like, over-the-top propaganda pieces about each other constantly. It's like a little silly. People make fun of North Korea a lot of the time because they talk about like how Kim Il-sung was, when Kim Il-sung was born, the sky opened up and lightning hit the top of the mountains and that formed the mountain. Like, this, it's a whole thing. It's very interesting propaganda, but there's also like a lot more subtle propaganda that is actively being produced by a lot of different parties. Japan also produces a lot. China produces a lot because there's, the conflict here is like very central ideologically. But there are a few theories as to why he did not end up in charge. There is a story that the press loves to say, and there's a story that he himself claimed. Because if you're a dictator, or closely related to a dictator, you can't just travel around the world, like willy-nilly, seeing the sights, because someone's gonna get you, or bother you a lot, or the CIA is gonna want to ask questions of you. So what you do instead is, you travel under a fake ID. And in 2001, Kim Jong-nam went to Japan with two women and his son in order to go to Tokyo Disneyland. They were instead arrested on arrival in the airport due to their fake passports. Japan then detained him, which led to a lot of international news and embarrassment for his father and the regime. And this allegedly led to him no longer being considered the heir and falling out of favor within the family.
Because he was arrested?
Yeah, because he was going to Disneyland. You can't go to Disneyland if you're going to be like the leader of like a communist nation. You got arrested by the Japanese.
Switzerland.
Yeah, but like he got away with that. Getting arrested in Japan because he wanted to go to Disneyland. I know, right? I personally don't actually believe this story quite a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't think that this is the reason why he did not end up being the heir of the nation.
I mean, it's probably just a made up reason, because his mom wasn't married to his dad, right? And they didn't want that stain in the...
The marriage part did not matter that much. That part after Kim Il-sung died did not matter that much. When Kim Jong-il was in charge, all of his sons had different mothers.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, I didn't write this down, but I'm pretty sure he had four children to four different mothers. So that part itself, I don't think mattered that much in the stain type of situation, but it could have still been embarrassing because this did become major news at the time. Like, because no one knows anything about what happens in North Korea in 2001. Like, it's people call it the Hermit Kingdom. And then suddenly, like, the heir to the dictatorship is in a Japanese jail. Like, it becomes, like, a thing. Like, what's going on? What are you doing? Can we ask you questions? Like, what's going on? Are there going to be an exchange? Things like that. And that embarrassment is apparently what a lot of people think led to him being falling out of favor. But again, I don't believe it. And I agree that it seems a little silly. He, though, argued that he fell out of favor because he wanted to be a reformer who wanted to introduce Chinese-style market economics to North Korea. China has market economics, different than the West has, but they do have market economics. North Korea does not. They have full planned economy. There's nothing. And this allegedly led his father to call him a filthy capitalist pig, which fit very well with his persona as a well-traveled cool kid who could fit in with foreign leaders, because he would apparently be quite like adept at going to other nations and like doing trade deals, more so than most other North Korean diplomats could do. So you could see why a lot of people outside of North Korea really wanted him to be the heir. Whichever the reason was, he was not the only player in this drama. Kim Jong-il had other children, and they also had ambition. Most notably, Kim Jong-un, who had better ties with the North Korean army. But I have also got to mention that there was another son, Kim Jong-shul, but he was apparently too girlish to ever be considered as part of like the hierarchy, and femboys can't be dictators, as we all know. So Kim Jong-nam fell out of favor, kept a low profile, and stayed out of North Korean business, generally. But in 2012, Kim Jong-un became leader of the country after the death of his father, and the future of the nation was very much up in the air. This was also a time when relations between the nation and the rest of the world were very tense. You may remember hearing about nuclear weapon tests and ballistic missile trials around this time. I remember specifically hearing about like a nuclear detonation underground that happened during this time. Well, Kim Jong-un did a lot of like weapons tests that really upset a lot of foreign neighbors. And Kim Jong-un actually starts talking a lot about nuking other nations. Like it sounds like he's like, hey, I'm gonna do it. And this tension kept going for many, many years with more missile tests. There was also artillery shelling from the north into South Korea. And South Korea even revealed that they had plans for assassinating Kim Jong-un if the tension like didn't stop very, very quickly.
They just revealed that?
I know, they just told people that. Yeah, we're gonna kill him. You can't do that. He's still around. Like, he's the dictator right now. You're just like, you're trying to kill me? But this was apparently not, like, super unknown to the North Koreans. Like, they know that people want to kill him.
Yeah.
Especially the South Koreans.
I would guess that it wasn't, like, it wasn't difficult for them to know that South Korea wanted to kill him. But still, yeah, it's a little weird to just go to the news and be like, announcement. We're gonna kill Kim Jong-un.
So, there was a lot of talk of potentially war, nuclear war, instability, at the very least, that all of this drama was creating, possibly leading to Kim Jong-un being deposed. Could be war on the continent. Maybe someone's going to kill him. Maybe someone's going to assassinate him. But no one knows what's going to happen. Now, if only there was a viable replacement candidate from the right family, who people in the West liked, and who was previously groomed for the role, just in case everything went to shit.
It's good to have a spare, you know?
It's good to have a spare, but not if you're the heir. Suddenly, Kim Jong-nam started looking like a possible threat to Kim Jong-un's stability. And this is what leads us into his assassination. In 2017, Kim Jong-nam was traveling from Kuala Lumpur to Macau, where he was most likely living at the time. And while checking into his flight, two women walked up to him and wiped a wet cloth on his face before quickly walking away.
Just wiped? Like, just strangers came and wiped something on his face?
Mm-hmm. One after the other. Well, like, one come up, wiped something on his face, and then the other one came up and also wiped something on his face.
Did
the second
fight?
Woman actually didn't even have a cloth. They just had, like, a wet fluid on her hands.
Did he fight back? How do you just... Did he not have, like, bodyguards surrounding him at all times?
No.
He just, like, traveled a commercial airline?
So he lived in semi, like, exile at the time. And traveling under, like, a pseudonym. Like, he's keeping a low profile. Like, he's not really, like... He's not traveling as a person of authority. He's just a guy who's, like, out of North Korean business. He's not a politician.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just imagining myself in the situation. If a stranger walks up to me and, like, reaches their hand towards my face, I'm throwing hands. And I'm certainly not letting another person come up to me and do the same fucking shit.
Yeah, but they snuck up on him. The second woman specifically came up from behind also, and allegedly pulled her hands from behind on his eyes and then pulled downwards into his
mouth. The first woman did that.
The second one.
Okay, but after one person does that to you, you look around a little bit.
it's a crowded airport. Like, there's going to be people walking around. You know what I mean? Like, it's difficult to tell if someone's walking past you and if someone's going to walk up to you. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And this happened very, very quickly, by the way. Now, Kim Jong-nam quickly fell ill, got very dizzy, had a seizure at the airport, and died on the way to the hospital. The two women were Siti Aisha and Duang Ti-hyung, and they were also the ones arrested after being identified on security cameras. But they claim, and camera footage confirms, that they did not act alone, because four North Korean agents had been in the country for some time and laid the foundations, allegedly grooming these two women into carrying out the act. And they were also spotted on camera, like, observing the assassination. Mm. And they were never caught. They flew away on flights.
The agents themselves.
Because they only discovered them after, the women had gotten arrested and interviews and, camera footage has confirmed. But at that point, the agents had already, left on their flights and were gone. And they specifically had gone on flights that would not be grounded by nations who could arrest them.
Mm-hmm.
The women's story was that they had been told to do this as part of a Japanese prank show. But whether or not this was just a cover story is difficult to fully know, but this does seem to be the accepted explanation. In my mind, though, it is a little bit weird to just, in an airport, hey, go and smear this substance on a person's face. It's for the show.
It's gonna be funny, I promise.
They were also promised $100. To do it, which is an insultingly low amount for what turned out to be an actual assassination. The cloth itself had been doused in the nerve agent VX. And VX is an acetylcholine esterase inhibitor, which is a type of chemical compound used in medicines, in insecticides, and chemical weapons. It is odorless, tasteless, colorless, but due to difficulty reaching high purity, it does often end up being yellowish in color.
Yellowish?
Yellow, yeah, like amber, it's been called. Yeah. Walk up to if someone walks up to you with a piss rag, be scared. More scared than maybe you would normally be by a piss rag.
The reason I laughed is because you said jello-ish. You know how you don't hear the difference.
Swedish accent. Yeah. Yellow.
Go ahead.
I love yogurt.
See, now you're saying it right.
I can't tell.
You can't tell. You usually say joggurt.
Jesus. This compound works as a nerve agent by binding to the enzyme acetylcholinesterase, which is used to break down the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, which you use to tighten your muscles to get them to do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell I'm not used to writing about chemical compounds on the history person.
I'm very interested to see you carry out this portion.
It's difficult. I struggled through writing this segment. Like, I had a hard time being like, muscles? Okay, there's a compound that makes you do... Okay, then you have to... Like, it translates into this? Okay.
I love also how the muscles are tightening.
Is that not...
Contracting.
Okay, well, the sources I had said tightening. Reasonably... When you're done with your muscles, you need to be able to relax the muscle, and that's when acetylcholinesterase comes in, breaking down acetylcholine into acetic acid and choline. But when VX molecules bind to acetylcholinesterase, they render the enzyme incapable of doing that, and that's a permanent thing. It permanently alters those enzymes, which leads to acetylcholine building up in the neuromuscular junction.
Mm.
This makes the entire nervous system overstimulated, causing muscle twitching, sweating, smaller pupils, with more severe symptoms presenting on higher doses, such as convulsions and paralysis. It kills you via asphyxiation, both due to the muscles responsible for breathing being affected, but also by fluid building up in the airways that you can't get rid of, because this affects your entire nervous system, so you can't do anything. It's also a very potent nerve agent, and it can kill you by just direct skin exposure. You don't need to ingest it, really. And it can be easily produced, if you prepare properly. And this is most likely why two assassins were used, because they could each douse the target with a precursor, making it less risky for the assassins themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you take two ingredients that are just safe on their own, mix them on the target, and then it becomes VX. And it also would have made it easier to smuggle in the compounds into the airport and into the country. The two women, Siti Aisha and Dong Chihong, initially faced murder trials with the possibility of the death penalty, but have since both been released, with Dong instead being sentenced for a lesser charge, but who has now also been released.
Mm.
She had to serve a couple of years for involuntary cause of death of another, but she has served that sentence now, and she is now also released.
But was that story about the Japanese show believed? Like,
so that is the idea. The general idea behind their involvement is that they did not know what they were doing in this assassination attempt,
okay.
And that the real assassins were the North Korean agents.
Okay,
That's at least the idea from the court. There is some theories that say that they knew what they were doing, but they don't seem to have gotten more money. They were very easily caught. They don't seem to have been trained assassins in that sense. They never tried to escape. It seems like they were set up in this situation.
Mm.
At the same time, though, it is difficult to see a lot of evidence for why they would think that there would be a game show. They never saw any cameras, as far as they could tell. They never saw any production team. They were promised $100 for something that probably should have been paid more. And they were also seen smearing fluids on strangers' faces in a nearby mall a couple of days before, which, that could have been interpreted as, them doing shots for the prank show or as them practicing for the assassination. Because it's also, a very specific type of, thing that they're doing, right? They're smearing a thing, on a person's face, specifically trying to, get to, orifices and the eyes and, airways.
That's not a good prank. No, and that's the part that is a bit sketchy. Imagine being trained to do that. Get on the face, but make sure to get it.
It has to get in the eyes.
In the eyes and the breathing orifices.
Mm-hmm. And
it's a little sus.
It's very sus. But the court seems to have been very comfortable, believing their story here. North Korea, for their part, has, of course, denied involvement. But it is pretty much an open secret that the killing was ordered by Kim Jong-un. The larger question is why. One reason is probably because his existence was a threat to his position, a threat made all the more dangerous by the fact that Nam apparently was very well liked by Chinese officials. And because China has such a huge influence over North Korean politics and their economy, if China wants to get rid of Kim Jong-un, he could have been like the guy they put in place instead of him. And like, when Big Brother likes someone else more than you, that's dangerous to you. Another reason could also be to deter other defectors or former high officials of the North Korean regime from talking to the public or Western media, because this was something that Kim Jong-nam was doing. He was one of the only like high officials who was like taking interviews.
Babylon.
Yeah, he was Babylon.
He
was the only person of the leadership family of North Korea who ever talked to Western media until Kim Jong-un talked to a journalist in 2019. But that was it was pretty rare for to have that like Western insight into the family. But also, diplomats and former officials were also talking to media and like talking to the world about what's going on within North Korea. But this did not happen after the assassination. And this is also a theory as to why it happened in such a public space as an airport, so that it was really a message to people to watch their step. Like, we can get ya. Stop talking to the fucking media. And then the third reason, which was revealed as late as 2019, because then the Wall Street Journal published a story that Nam was in fact working with the CIA, and at the time of his assassination, allegedly had just met up with a CIA contact. So maybe this was a spy drama all along, but of course we can't know for sure. There's a lot of bad information about this assassination though, and frankly a lot of disrespectful coverage of the event, with some news outlets describing him during the assassination as a chubby man wobbling around the airport, which is a wild way to describe a political assassination.
Mm.
Especially like of a person that like you would probably prefer over Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
Just like, this guy could have resolved so much fucking issues in like Southeast Asia. And you decide to call him chubby?
Wobbling around. Yeah, I feel a little bad because I did kind of make fun of Rasputin's assassination.
To be fair, that was not as present in time.
Not as present. He was kind of a weird guy.
I think you can make fun of Rasputin.
And we all know if it's a weird guy, you can make fun of him.
Comedy is history plus time. You know what I mean? Like, you can make fun of things that far back in time.
That's the formula.
It's not like Rasputin's actions or like his context is like super relevant in like modern day politics. But his definitely is. You know, like, this is less than a decade old. And I think in that case, it's just like, you can at least wait a decade before calling him chubby. Another reason why there's a lot of, like, disrespectful coverage of this and why there's a lot of misinformation about it and, like, contradicting coverage is because the security camera footage went viral after this assassination. And that was apparently, like, a big factor as to why a lot of news outlets decided to report on it without really checking their facts first, because they kind of just reported on what they saw in the news footage, which, if you look at it without any context, does look a little silly, because you do see him sort of like lay splayed on like one of those airport terminal like chairs. But also, he's dying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, why
like
are we
making... actively watching a guy die.
Yeah, like, why are we making... like, oh, he's wobbling around. Yes, he has been assassinated. He's currently dying from a nerve agent. Like, So anyway, that is my story on Kim Jong-un's brother, Kim Jong-nam.
Very good.
Well, this has been our episode on assassinations, various methods, and some interesting stories from history about some famous assassinations.
I enjoyed talking about Russia greatly.
Mm.
I hope
oh, I
you...
Bet.
Oh. What is that supposed to mean?
I didn't mean it as a shitty way. Like, it's interesting.
Russia's so interesting. And I think especially that period, like late 19th, early 20th. Perfect.
You can see why Lenin said that there are decades when weeks happen and there are weeks when decades happen. Mm. Because like I feel like a lot of weeks when decades happened. So true.
Yeah, there are a lot of weeks when decades happened for sure.
Mm.
And also, I mean, Rasputin is just such an interesting guy.
Right?
I wouldn't be surprised if like some of the things that I said were mostly myths.
Mm.
But come on, I had to add like a little bit to the story.
You gotta, I mean, like, yes, of course. And I think it's okay to also like mention, because you did also mention a few facts that you're like, this is disputed. Mm-hmm. Like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. As long as you mention it's disputed, we're not spreading misinformation.
Mm-hmm. Cope.
as opposed to the fucking New York Post, which got like multiple dates wrong, in my case, in the assassination of King Jong-nam. There's a New York Post article that just like accuses a random Chinese guy of also like being the mastermind of the assassination. You can't do that. I didn't know newspapers could just be like, this is the guy, he did it. He's like, I'm making food. I'm making dinner. What?
Okay, but this has been our episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you enjoyed it, and if you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review on Spotify or whatever streaming service you may be using. And if you enjoyed it a lot, consider checking out our Patreon. With that being said, we will see you in the next episode.
Bye-bye.